me to speak at the London School. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here. I want to talk today about the prospects for a new field of applied historical studies, what I would call the historical epidemiology of global health or the historical epidemiology of contemporary disease challenges. That offers an opportunity for medical historians to bridge the chasm between the study of historical disease outbreaks and the work of contemporary global health interventionists. It holds the potential to bring historical research to bear on some contemporary global health problems in order to improve health outcomes. So the talk I'm going to give today is relatively brief. It has three parts. The first part deals with the field of historical epidemiology itself and why it's important. The second part deals with the historical roots of historical epidemiology and the possibility of its reemergence as a field of research. And the third part offers some reflections on the way forward. So, part one. What do I mean by historical epidemiology? I'll define it as the study, the historical study of efforts to control disease over time and space that takes into account variables that are frequently left out of epidemiological studies, and the ways in which past control efforts have transformed patterns of disease and influenced disease transmission. It brings the work of medical historians into dialogue with the public health sciences with the goal of achieving better understandings of disease processes and the effects of global health interventions. So I'm arguing kind of for a very specific kind of historical study that really targets public health interventions and with the effort to try and improve them, kind of leverage historical evidence. The historical epidemiology of contemporary disease challenges is multidisciplinary in approach, integrating historical research and biomedical knowledge to explore the historical records of disease control. I think that it has the promise of developing as a fundamental resource for global public health. At present, this field of study is largely undeveloped. Why is that? Well, a central reason is that historical epidemiology is uncomfortably multidisciplinary in methods and in approach. The disciplinary biases of many graduate programs discourage multidisciplinary training. Few epidemiologists have trained in history. Few historians have any literacy in epidemiology, entomology, parasitology, immunology, or other public health sciences. Let me share a couple of personal experiences that have helped to convince me of the utility of historical epidemiology. A few years ago, I gave a talk at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, at a technical conference to assess the progress of contemporary malaria eradication efforts in Nigeria and Ethiopia. I made a presentation on the historical efforts to eradicate malaria in West Africa in the 1950s and 1960s during the malaria eradication program led by the World Health Organization. Although it's frequently stated in the scientific literature that tropical Africa did not participate in the global malaria eradication program of the 1950s and 1960s, in fact, the historical record is replete with projects to try and develop eradication protocols in all of the ecological zones of tropical Africa with the intention of scaling up these efforts in order to achieve eradication. The African pilot malaria eradication programs were launched using synthetic residual insecticides such as DDT, dieldrin, and lindane. They achieved very impressive successes, dramatically reducing the transmission of malaria through the use of indoor residual spraying with synthetic insecticides. But the projects couldn't reach their goal of zero transmission, and they couldn't sustain the control. The synthetic insecticides placed heavy selection pressure on the mosquito vectors and produced resistance in the mosquitoes to the insecticides, often within a year or so of extensive use. It's a photograph of the repeated applications of synthetic insecticides in Liberia in the course of one of the pilot malaria eradication projects of the 1950s. And this is kind of an overview of the resistance to synthetic insecticides. Quite different experiences in West Africa than in East Africa, and different yet in Southern Africa. DLD is dieldrin, HCH and PHC are other classes of synthetic insecticides. So when these indoor residual spraying initiatives eventually produced resistance, the pilot eradication programs turned to mass drug administration with pyrimethamine, with chloroquine, and sometimes with primaquine. A major challenge was how to get drugs to the entire population, particularly rural populations, in project zones. There were a variety of different approaches. One was mixing the anti-malarials with salt and providing it to the population on the idea that everybody used salt, and this is going to be a way to get drugs into the body of the rural populations. And it was tried in northern Ghana, in Tanzania and Uganda. Elsewhere, project managers oversaw the direct distribution of anti-malarials to people in project zones. And an alternative approach was what was called unmonitored direct distribution, which meant that drugs were provided to village heads or other local authorities that in turn distributed them. Researchers judged that the overall impact of these chemotherapeutic interventions, mass drug administration, to be unimpressive. Pyrimethamine was initially highly efficacious, but pyrimethamine produced resistance in the parasite, falciparum parasite, within a few months. Chloroquine alone, or chloroquine in combination with primaquine, also cleared infections, but the prospects for long-term prophylaxis seemed poor. The major impediment, deemed nearly insuperable, was the establishment of a regular rhythm of distribution and use. Moreover, it was found that even in combination with indoor residual spraying, anti-malarial drugs could drive the levels of infection extremely low, but not to the point of fully interrupting transmission. This is a photograph from the 1950s, the same era of the pilot eradication project. And this is a slide which gives an overview of some of the experiences with mass drug administration, including down here at the bottom, chloroquine tablets, sometimes in combination with primaquine. So I gave this talk in Atlanta, and immediately after my presentation, two high-ranking members of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation rushed over to me and asked me if they had understood correctly. Was it true that Primaquine had been used in some of the pilot malaria eradication projects? This was of great concern to them. Why? Oh, they were getting ready to launch a major program of mass drug administration in Africa using Primaquine. And they had no idea that there were earlier malaria eradication programs in Africa in which Primaquine had been used. The concern was that for people who carry the G6PD genetic mutation, just the most common genetic mutation in human beings, it's perfectly safe to give a first dose of Primaquine over the course of a lifetime, but the application of administration of a second dose can produce illness, or at the extreme, even death. The Gates Foundation rushed to organize a meeting of malaria historians to discuss the earlier malaria campaigns in Africa, and the Primaquine Mass Drug Administration program had to be rethought. Another anecdote, this one about the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, also in Atlanta. Several years ago, I gave a talk to the entomologists at the CDC about the historical experience with indoor residual spraying in tropical Africa in the 1950s and 1960s. The CDC entomologists were very keen to learn about these experiences because they noted, well, these were the exact same experiences they were having now. Without knowing it, they were using the same classes of insecticides, and sometimes the exact same insecticides, in the same region, on the same mosquito populations, without knowing that there had been earlier interventions. To me, this was particularly striking because the CDC had in fact spearheaded the use of indoor residual spraying in West Africa, in Liberia, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Yet, there was no one in the malaria division of the CDC who had ever even heard of the Liberian projects. And there were no archives of CDC materials that bore on this. So, what this means, of course, is that global health interventions are sometimes launched without knowledge of previous disease control efforts in the same region, against the same pathogens, using the same sets of tools. These two instances that I've mentioned suggest something very basic, that the study of past public health interventions can improve contemporary campaigns simply by not having them unknowingly repeat the experiences of the past. I've used two examples from malaria control, but other examples could be advanced from other control campaigns against other diseases. I think probably the lowest hanging fruit is that of the neglected tropical diseases. Neglected tropical diseases, in part because the neglect suggests, usually accurately, that there was a period of neglect that followed earlier interventions, and that there are earlier interventions which can be explored fruitfully. I think that at a minimum, historical epidemiology can make a valuable contribution to global health across virtually the entire array of neglected tropical diseases. That was part one. Now we move to part two. Historical epidemiology has its roots in observations about the environmental determinants of disease that have been associated with place. In the Western world, an approach known as medical geography, developed in the late 19th century in an effort to catalog information about the past incidence and spatial distribution of the disease. In the 1940s, as new biomedical understandings of infectious diseases began to transform the practice of medicine and public health interventions, the medical historian Edwin Ackerknecht inaugurated the modern subdiscipline of historical epidemiology in his efforts to integrate across disciplines that often don't speak to each other, to integrate biomedical evidence in a field of social, economic, and environmental historical forces, and to try and investigate change over time. This approach would be taken up by other historians whose research would transform historical perspectives, for example, on the history of Africa and its relationship to the Atlantic world, and make a persuasive case for the centrality of infectious disease processes in global history. This phase of historical epidemiology produced radically new perspectives on global history, but it had no discernible impact on public health planning or practice. Today, at a time of transition in medical history, when the new rubric of medical humanities is ascendant, I want to raise the question as to whether medical historians should forge a new bridge to the public health sciences and to develop an historical field of study that focuses on integrating perspectives from epidemiology, ecology, and public health. It will be challenging in its multidisciplinarity, but perhaps now is the propitious moment to do so. In my view, the emerging field of historical epidemiology has the potential to harness the analytical and research skills of the historian with the promise of improving contemporary disease control interventions. One thrust is through the reintroduction of lost public health knowledge, for example, in vector control. Consider, for example, the current crisis posed by the Aedes mosquito that can transmit Zika virus, as well as yellow fever virus, dengue fever virus, chikungunya virus. There's currently an emphasis, driven by the virologists, on the development of vaccines against these dangerous pathogens. Yet the historical experience with antiviral vaccines in the tropical world has been quite mixed. Consider the yellow fever virus. We've had a nearly 100% effective vaccine against the yellow fever virus since 1932. But in many regions, the vaccine has not been administered to populations at risk. This is the background, of course, to the 2016 epidemic outbreak of yellow fever in Angola and Democratic Republic of Congo. There are other historical experiences with Aedes control, Aedes aegypti control, about 100 years of intermittent vector control in the Americas that has to date gone largely uninterrogated. These historical efforts were highly effective. This was one of the central programs of PAHO in the 1950s and into the 1960s that resulted in the elimination of Aedes aegypti from most of the Americas. These historical efforts were highly effective, and an interrogation of these historical programs would likely prove useful to inform contemporary disease control efforts in the Americas. In part because, the dengue vaccines, even if we could get them to the populations, aren't terribly effective. Zika vaccine is in a very early stage of development. There is no vaccine for chikungunya. Rather than approaching this on a pathogen basis, oh, let's go after Zika. No, let's go after chikungunya. No, let's go after yellow fever. Another approach, complementary approach, one that wouldn't have to displace efforts at vaccine development, would be to reinterrogate the history of vector control. Because once you control Aedes, you shut down the transmission of yellow fever, Zika, dengue, and chikungunya all at once. Historical epidemiological studies may also make contributions to our understandings of infectious disease processes by situating them in historical ecological processes. For example, the powerful forces of biome conversion, forced resettlement, and urbanization have long altered conditions in which infectious diseases can be transmitted. And depending upon the pathogen, these forces may have amplified or may have suppressed transmission. As examples, one might note that in tropical Africa, the processes of rapid urbanization have concentrated a demand for bushmeat in cities and thereby increased the prospects for the introduction of zoonotic pathogens from their wild animal victims. Refugee camps without adequate provision for treatment of human waste have facilitated the transmission of diseases transmitted by fecal-oral route, and cholera has thereby become an endemic disease in Africa. Yet the pollution of water sources in some of the major peri-urban areas has had a contrary effect on the transmission of malaria. It's reduced the transmission of malaria because the mosquito vectors need clean water in which to breed. Yet another fertile field of inquiry will be the impacts of the various disease control interventions on broader ecologies. The current malaria control campaigns, for example, are operating in an environment that has been significantly altered by the global malaria eradication campaigns in the 1950s and 1960s. The earlier campaigns' use of synthetic insecticides selected for alleles in the vector mosquitoes that provide resistance to the synthetic insecticides. And it's possible that the mix of vector mosquitoes was also altered significantly by the disease control interventions. I mean, we see this in some areas of, you know, West Africa, where you have a kind of differential response to the residual insecticides, so that if you have populations of Anopheles gambi and Anopheles funestus that are the principal carriers, transmitters of malaria, my gosh, once you apply residual insecticides, Anopheles funestus virtually disappeared, and into that ecological niche expanded Anopheles gambi. So you have a different mix of populations as a result of these earlier interventions. This is not the same world in which interventionists are working. It's also possible, indoor residual house spraying and during the contemporary campaign, insecticide-treated bed nets produced heavy selection pressures on indoor biting mosquitoes. Why? I mean, these residual spraying campaigns were on the walls of houses, typically the indoor walls. The bed nets are for use inside the houses. We're killing off mosquitoes that are biting indoors. It's possible it's forcing the evolution of different behaviors, outdoor biting Anopheles mosquitoes. In retrospect, historical epidemiological studies may provide new ways of understanding the biological constraints under which contemporary disease control projects are working. A concomitant impact may be felt in the field of ecological studies. as it becomes evident that the ecological worlds in which the campaigns operate are themselves, in part, the artifacts of past interventions. The integration of this knowledge into contemporary epidemiological modeling may produce more realistic and less idealistic programmatic recommendations. That was part two. Now we move to part three. It seems obvious that any new interventions in global health should be informed by a full knowledge of previous disease control campaigns in the same regions, as well as interventions against the same pathogens that have been embarked upon elsewhere. This explicit subject area, however, is largely missing from the curricula of schools of public health. Many schools of public health do not have historians of medicine or public health on staff, and few, if any, teach the history of global health interventions. Indeed, even in many of the leading schools that specialize in global health, there are no historians of tropical medicine or historians of global public health, and few, if any, resources devoted to the historical epidemiology of contemporary disease challenges. How to remedy this situation? There would seem to be two prime orders of business. The first is within the academy. Perhaps it's time to encourage historians of medicine to undertake research that has a direct bearing on contemporary disease challenges. One solution may be to promote joint degree programs in history and global health. Philanthropic organizations such as the Wellcome Trust could be a major innovator by funding positions in historical epidemiology in schools of public health and through the creation of an institute for multidisciplinary research on contemporary disease challenges. Its charge would be the collection and analysis of data on global health interventions in their local and regional contexts. The second order of business is to encourage transparency among global health donors and to improve the conservation of global health intervention data. The global health community and the individual states with responsibilities for their population's health need to collect and preserve records of what has happened in the course of contemporary control programs. This is not done to a shocking degree. This must necessarily involve records of failures, problems, obstacles, glitches. This is made difficult by the donor culture of program evaluation that suppresses the social, political, and cultural dimensions of interventions, and by the exclusive valorization of positive data for publication. It's time to appreciate that there's a great deal to be learned from partial success and failure that can improve future interventions. The emerging field of the historical epidemiology of contemporary disease challenges has the potential to integrate a number of disparate fields of knowledge. It will depend upon the conservation and accessibility of the records of public health interventions, including the gray literatures of public health services, global health donors, and non-governmental health organizations. The World Health Organization, for example, has an extensive archive that a new generation of historians is beginning to consult. Other international actors, however, are lagging far behind in their record-keeping practices. And as a result, important resources for the global epidemiological past are either inaccessible or are being discarded. The Gates Foundation, one of the most important Global Health Actors has no archive. Center for Disease Control produces its morbidity and mortality weekly report, yet remarkably, the CDC has no comprehensive archive. So, to sum up, it seems to me to be a propitious moment to advance the field of historical epidemiology. It's dangerous for global health planners to neglect the long and informative record of past disease control efforts in the hope that new technologies or new techniques are going to prove determinative in the future. This is most clear-cut in the case of the so-called neglected tropical diseases, although undoubtedly the applications of historical epidemiology will be developed more broadly to include chronic disease as well. To put it in the language of public health, ignorance of the epidemiological past constitutes a significant global health risk. That's what I have to say. So thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions, challenges.